From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Welcome, Thanksgiving. It's almost here, the holiday when Americans cook. Get in the kitchen and roll up their sleeves, make a mess, make a miracle. Just the effort makes Mark Bittman happy. He's the super guru of food at the New York Times, best-selling cookbook author, and big thinker about life and all things food, how we grow it, share it, prepare it. This hour on Point, we're talking turkey and a whole lot more with the great Mark Bittman. You can join the conversation. Where are you right now in your Thanksgiving ritual? Are you baking pies, chopping cranberries, trying something new? What's your food question, great or small, for this Thanksgiving's meal? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We'll be joined this hour by a Vermont farmer who's been wrapping up her harvest and preparing for the winter for a farm's eye view of Thanksgiving. But first, Mark Bittman, home cooking guru, celebrated author of How to Cook Everything and Food Matters, A Guide to Conscious Eating. He's got a show on the Cooking Channel, and he's spread his wings onto the opinion pages of the New York Times and his food column for the Times Magazine. He joins us from Montpelier, Vermont. Mark Bittman, welcome back to the show. Happy Thanksgiving, sir.
And to you, Tom. Nice to talk with you again.
It's great to have you with us. The last time we talked, you were talking about your vegan till dinner time style of life that had helped you shed a lot of pounds, get healthier, and get more maybe in tune with the planet. Mark, do you celebrate with meat on Thanksgiving, with turkey?
I go with the flow, and the flow is turkey and stuffing and pie, and there's about sort of nothing untraditional about what we're doing tomorrow.
Embrace the tradition and just go with it. We're going to look at that and a lot of options as well. I mean, I'm looking here at a recipe from you, the 45-minute roast turkey. Now, I have to say that doesn't line up with my many years' experience. I'm the turkey guy in our house, and it's hours and hours and hours and hours. How does a 45-minute turkey work?
I probably will do that tomorrow. It's a split, or it used to, the word used to be spatchcocked. It's a spatchcock turkey, which basically means you take out the backbone and then you flatten it and roast it spread-eagled like that, and or spread-turkeyed like that. And, you know, it cooks really, really fast, 45 minutes to an hour, and it's done. And you get great crispness on the skin, and the thighs get cooked and the breast stays fairly moist. It's a good technique.
It sounds terrific, but you know, one of the things that I really enjoy about Thanksgiving is the way that it sort of makes everybody happy hostages in the kitchen for hours and hours. I guess it is the favorite thing in our household about Thanksgiving. You often write about how Americans just don't cook enough anymore. For all the time we spend talking and thinking about food, we've become strangers in our own kitchens. This is a holiday that tends to get people back in there and in there together, Mark.
It's true. While I love Thanksgiving, I do this whole period from now till New Year's, it kind of gets my ire up a little bit because we start obsessing about food in a completely different way and it becomes central in a different way. And, of course, my argument is that it should be central 365 days a year. We should be cooking a lot more than we do, and we should, you know, not that there's anything wrong with feasts and holidays, but that food should be a daily celebration, I guess I would say.
Well, I'm all for that, but I guess if we're giving thanks for things tomorrow, let's be at least thankful for the days when people are in that kitchen. I mean, it takes a lot to blast people back in there sometimes and remember the simple pleasures of kneading the bread dough or just getting the vegetables, peeling the apples, just the visceral pleasure in cooking, Mark.
Yeah, again, I would argue that that could be a much more routine part of everyone's life. And then I wonder with the pressures of Thanksgiving, of having 12 and 16 and 20 people into your house,
true.
Whether it really is such a joyous occasion for the main cook.
Yeah. You'd better learn how to share the labor or really go with the flow, or it might not be. Remind us why, and this is it's always your theme, but why you think it's so important for Americans to cook. It's not just the act of cooking. It's what that act, sort of all the knock-on effects of being the cook oneself, Mark.
You know, it's funny because the act of cooking is often overlooked, and it is the act of cooking really can be a pleasure. But that is towards the bottom of importance. the top is really taking control over what you eat. And if you cook, you tend to shop more intelligently. You tend to think about what you're putting in your mouth more. And obviously, you have much more control over things. If cooking becomes a part of your life, then you're planning what you're going to eat. You're not eating spur of the moment while you're driving by some fast food joint that's shouting, have it your way at you. You're thinking about what you're going to have for dinner and you're planning it. Obviously, it's not the easiest thing for many people to have the time, and some people don't have the skills or even the kitchens for that matter. But the whole spirit of cooking to me is a spirit of thinking about what you're eating, planning what you're eating. It's not entirely about applying heat to food. It's mm-hmm. about, as I said, really having control over what you put in your mouth.
I would think in some ways, yes, it's got its issues, but Thanksgiving, the Thanksgiving meal, the kind of traditional one, might line up fairly well with the kind of cooking that you often celebrate in that it embraces it, its seasonality, which makes it easier. I mean, you're going. I mean, got recipes from you here for butternut squash braised and glazed and roast carrots and Brussels sprouts. It is an autumn feast. It goes with what nature tends to provide in autumn in its traditional form, Mark.
Totally true. And the irony is because turkey is not really that great, I think many people tend to celebrate the vegetables and as you say, the seasonality of the thing. I mean, of course, we want this big – or most of us want this big centerpiece bird. But the fact is that by the time you've put six different vegetable dishes on your plate, you're eating a different style of meal than you normally do. And again, it's a great – if we remember the origins of this thing, that there is a – that there is a harvest, that things wrap up right about now, that mm-hmm. that many people 100, 200 years ago were looking at a much more difficult period of the year coming up. That makes the feast so understandable and so natural. The problem today is that we gorge almost every day, and so Thanksgiving just is like an extra gorge.
Almost every day and on any kind of food from all over the planet. I saw blueberries on sale the other day from, of all things, Easter Island, the Pacific Island with those famous, large, huge, ancient stone heads. Blueberries from Easter Island? Are you kidding me?
Really impressive.
Wow, I was blown away. Blueberry pickers around those giant heads. Mark Bittman is with us, the great New York Times food writer, all the way from recipes up to the greatest questions and issues of food in our society, in our culture, on our planet. Louisa is calling from Chittenden, Vermont. Louisa, you're on the air with Mark Bittman. What's your question?
Hi, Tom. I was calling. I know that standard fare these days discourages people from stuffing the turkey, but I really think it tastes the best.
Yeah.
But that way, the stuffing in particular, and I'm just wondering, what's the general roasting time for a stuffed turkey, because it doesn't come with those directions on the bag anymore.
Mark, give us if you're going to do it the old-fashioned way and stuff it right there, what do you like for stuffing, and how do you then roast it, Mark?
I would just because it's in my nature, I would say that I'd argue that stuffing is better cooked outside of the bird. However, if the bird is done, which means that the meatiest part of the thigh is at somewhere around 160 degrees, then the stuffing is done too. Timing, depends on the size of the bird, how cold it is, how hot the oven is, and so on.
So 160 degrees, and if you've got, I don't know, if you've got that bigger 8, 10, 12, and you're going up towards a 15 or 16 or 18-pound bird, what are you going to count on? It's going to be hours. It's not going to be a 45-minute splayed bird.
Definitely not.
And keep that in mind, Louisa, or dinner may come very, very late in the evening. One more quick one here. Amy in Queensbury, New York. Amy, you're on the air with Mark Bittman.
Hi, Mark. Hi, Tom. Hi. Happy Thanksgiving.
Same to you.
Thank you. I have one quick question about cheesecake. Of all the recipes that are out there, it always calls for softened cream cheese. How long does the cream cheese need to be softened? Is it an all-day deal like it is with butter, or is it just a couple of hours?
What do you say, Mark?
I would say, again, it depends on how warm your kitchen is, but a couple hours will do it in almost every scenario. And if you're using you know, a standing mixer, something with some power, I don't think the softening is really all that important anyway, because the mixer will take care of that.
Just power through.
Exactly.
You don't tend to be real finicky in your recipes. It's kind of a what deal with circumstances as they come, Mark.
Well, in part that's because I'm not finicky. I think that's right. But in part, I think that it's people want simple, straightforward answers, but it's not always that simple. You know, the cream cheese question is a great question. How long does it take to soften cream cheese? Well, is your kitchen 58 degrees or 78 degrees? It makes a big difference.
We're talking about the great questions of life here, from how long does it take to soften cream cheese to how do we feed this planet and feed it wisely and well this hour with Mark Bittman, the great food writer for the New York Times. Music from Jay Unger and Molly Mason behind us here in the Nashville Chamber Orchestra from their 1999 CD, Harvest Home. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point, and we're talking this hour about Thanksgiving, autumn feasting, and the food we eat with New York Times food guru Mark Bittman. He's author of Food Matters, How to Cook Everything Vegetarian. Millions of people follow him when it comes to not only preparing what goes on the table, but thinking about our whole great infrastructure of food as it is now, as it might be. He joins us today from Montpelier, Vermont, and it's just great to have him back with us. And in the same studio there, I think, we're delighted to have with us today Clotilde Hrischko, owner of Camp Hrischko, an organic farm and CSA, community-supported agriculture farm in Brookfield, Vermont. Clotilde, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
What a wonderful name, Clotilde Hrischko. Where is that from, Clotilde?
My parents picked the name out of a book. My father's Ukrainian, so that's my last name. But I am not French.
You're not French?
I'm not French. Hrischko. But I'm near the Quebec border, so everyone assumes that I'm French-Canadian.
Well, you've got exotic nailed right there from the get-go. What do you grow on your farm, Clotilde?
We are a diversified vegetable farm. We have a CSA. We also supply a restaurant about 5 miles from the farm in Brookfield. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We grow a huge variety of vegetables, which we offer through the CSA. We also do a flower cutting garden, which the CSA has able to take advantage of. And then we're getting into that process of growing a lot more of the fruit for our own use. We still are trying to master getting blueberries for our location. Mm-hmm. The first planting we lost to beavers along the river.
Wow.
And so that was years ago. But we have all our raspberries, things like that, that we can freeze and put away.
I thought beavers chopped down whole trees.
They came into your blueberry patch
and ate the little seedlings there?
The shoots.
The shoots.
It's more the shoots because they're such tender, the young bushes. So they were quite edible and quite yummy. Much better than an old tree.
A plague of beavers in the blueberry patch. That's something to think of. I'm looking here. It says you grow melons, asparagus, corn, beets, mm-hmm. pumpkins, onions, squash, garlic, potatoes, peppers, lettuce, and on and on and on. What was this harvest?
Correct.
What was your harvest like this year, Clotilde? How was it?
Vermont started the season with huge snowpack and a lot of rain. So there was a lot of moisture in the spring. We were not flooded, so we were very lucky about that. But, you know, with the floodplain, which we do have farmland in the floodplain, but we don't plant it with vegetables. But that was saturated. I can't remember not walking through puddles through June.
So what did that help and what did that hurt when it came to the crop?
What did it helped for us, we have floodplain, but where we plant our crops, we're sitting on top of 5 to 10 feet of gravel. So we can drain fairly easily to that lower field. So actually, as horrible as it sounds to the farmers who were hurt, this type of spring was actually very easy for us in the sense of we didn't have to water with transplanting. Our soil can dry out well enough to be able to still prep beds and do that type of thing so that we can plant. And then we don't have to worry about watering.
Mark Bittman, do you know Clotilde's farm? Have you used produce from her farm in your own cooking, Mark?
Yes, all the time. I don't come to Vermont without visiting Clotilde. And my father-in-law lives here, so I come here frequently.
What is it about Clotilde's farm that you particularly like?
Besides Clotilde, no, the stuff is really great. The variety is insane. So that, you know, from one month to the next, you never know what you're going to get. And because she has greenhouses and because she farm smart, the season starts early and goes real late. We will be eating, I'm not quite sure what, because I haven't picked my stuff up yet, but we will be eating Clotilde's vegetables tomorrow.
Clotilde, what are you still harvesting at this point? Or what are the latest things in your cycle of harvest?
Well, first off, this past Monday was a beautiful 50-degree sunny day, which we don't typically have in November. But if you looked at the forecast, you knew that snow was coming. We now have probably 10 to 12 inches at our inches of snow at our farm right now.
Wow. Okay.
But, yeah, it literally came very
and
quickly.
And outside the studio.
Yes, and outside the studio.
Okay. Winter wonderland.
So Monday was when I did a lot of harvesting, and partly because of the snow and partly because of the, you know, cold temperatures expected for the night.
What were you bringing in on Monday then?
So
before 10
on Monday,
inches of snow?
Just because the ground would freeze, you know, they'll do fine outside, but I wanted to bring in Brussels sprouts, leeks, anything like that. I harvested some lettuce and arugula for us to use as a family, but that's under row cover and it'll be fine as long as I harvest it when it's above freezing.
I mean, you must see Thanksgiving as a very locavore holiday because, I guess because of the historic roots of the whole thing and the menu that goes with it, it really is, you're in Vermont, this is a kind of New England autumn menu, straight up.
It certainly can, and you can certainly grow sweet potatoes in Vermont, but we don't because we just love like the Buttercup or Kaboko winter squashes.
Mm-hmm.
So that is our mash squash, but I would think the combination of, you know, the Brussels sprouts, whether they're roasted or just a plain steamed, there's almost like a brininess of them that goes incredibly well with the sweetened, whether it's the mashed sweet potato or if it's the Buttercup squash. That's the perfect. And then you have that, not blandness, but there is a blandness to mashed potatoes, which is actually very a wonderful compliment to all of that.
A happy blandness once the gravy comes on. We've got Judy writing here from maybe down the road from you. We're having our Vermont local feast turkey from another farm down the road, our own squash, our own potatoes, our own Brussels sprouts, local cranberries. Feeling blessed right there on the eve of Thanksgiving. And, of course, those menus pulled right across the country. That's what people are looking for when autumn comes around. Cheryl in Middleborough, Massachusetts, you're on the air with Mark Bittman and Clotilde Hrishko. Hi, Cheryl.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I'm calling with a question about cooking two turkeys in the same oven. They're roughly 12 pounds each. I'm not going to stuff them ahead of time. I'll do that separately.
Okay.
In terms of cooking that. And I'm calling about the length of time. Do I figure the amount of time I cook based on roughly a 12-pound bird or a 24-pound bird?
Oh, it sounds like a physics question. Mark, what do you say?
It's what I'm thinking. It is a physics question. I would split the difference. I mean, you know, the meat thermometer is going to be your friend in this instance, but it's going to be faster than a 24-pound bird, but it's going to be slower than one bird. And I think the other difference is whether you have convection or not, because if you have convection, they'll cook a little faster. But it's going to take, because if you're putting 24 pounds of cold stuff in there. It's going to take a long time for that oven to really start cooking those things. But, you know, if I had to guess, I would say a third longer than one bird. I wouldn't even say 50% longer. But I could very well be wrong.
So a little more than split the difference and watch that meat thermometer and pray that you can line everything up. Cheryl, thanks for calling. Sarah in Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts. Sarah, you're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. Hi.
Yeah, hi.
I have a question for Mark also.
Mm-hmm.
I have a local bird from Martha's Vineyard. It's 16 pounds. It's a heritage turkey. And I'm just curious about how to cook this type of bird versus the store-bought kind.
I think Clotilde has more experience with this than I do.
Well, first of all, what is a heritage turkey? Is it one you just shot in your backyard, Sarah?
I didn't shoot it. Somebody else did.
But
here
they, so by that, you just...
they're raising turkeys and butchering them here now.
But was it a wild turkey? I mean, turkeys are all over the place. I see them in my neighborhood, half a dozen of them. They look prehistoric.
We have a lot of wild turkeys. No, these are free-range turkeys, I think you could say.
Okay.
But they're not your standard variety that fattens up as quick, so they're actually raised for a longer period. I personally don't know if that, though, makes it so that it has more dark meat versus white and how that would affect the cooking.
Yeah.
But they take a longer time to basically reach maturity. But on the other hand, they're not usually or typically eating as much grain, protein, they're getting it from other things like the grass and the bugs.
So does it make them faster cookers or slower cookers or needing a different approach? What do you think?
You know,
that's
my question. That is your question. And you know what? The real answer is that those birds, a bird like that should probably not be roasted. And if it were roasted, the breast should be roasted and the legs should be braised. That would be the sort of academic culinary answer to the question because, what you've got there is not a bird that was raised in a cage. You've got a bird that actually has some muscle on it and therefore is going to be tougher. But, you know, that's not a popular answer because you want to present a roasted bird at the table. So I would probably tend to undercook it a little bit, if anything. I think it should probably be cooked a little less because it doesn't have as much fat. It's going to dry out more quickly. It's going to be tougher. And I would also sort of expect that it would be not as tender, not as soft and mushy as a store-bought industrially raised turkey.
Well, let's say you threw out the whole Rockwell picture of the turkey on the platter and just said, okay, this is more muscular, stringier, call it what you want, a heritage bird. And if you were going to roast it at all, what would you do with it? Turkey stew?
Well, no, I think that like chicken, but even more so, the white meat and the dark meat should be treated separately, and like game birds, I think the ideal turkey, and if you're going to start with a really good turkey, you can roast the breast, but quickly and without overcooking it. And the legs are better braised; they're better cooked with liquid because you need to be breaking down some of that really tough muscle. I think the best turkey dishes I've had in my life have been braised dark turkey meat because it becomes very pork-like, very tender, and quite succulent and delicious. But as you say, that's not the Rockwell painting.
Right. Sarah,
would be, if I'm not advocating going out and buying a smoker, but if there was a smoker in your neighborhood, that works very well for things like game birds just because there is moisture involved for the cooking, so that helps basically even out all of that.
How long does that take, Clotilde, if you go to
that,
the smoker?
Once the smoker is up to temperature, I typically, I smoke chickens and turkeys periodically, and I think if you said that 20 minute per pound rule, it's usually doubled, more like 35 to 40 minutes.
All right. So,
and I would certainly not stuff it.
Sarah, if you want to get really ambitious, find the neighborhood smokehouse, and you'll be off to the races there. Clotilde, do you notice people's approach to Thanksgiving changing? A lot of people have become so food conscious. Mark Bittman and many others have helped encourage that. Do you see different kinds of approaches to this day and its menus and its ingredients as that spreads out? Or do people just revert to form, to tradition, when Thanksgiving rolls around?
I think it's a combination of both. I mean, if you looked at any cooking magazine, there's always, let's try something new with beets. But everybody wants to do something that reminds them of what they have for a fond memory. So I like the stuffing, but I don't necessarily like it. What's considered a traditional stuffing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'd do something with wild rice. I started baking my bread on Monday to have for, the rest of the stuffing.
Mm-hmm.
But I certainly don't try to necessarily play with the vegetable dishes. I personally, like I said, that combination of those simple things mixed together, and to do something actually more adventurous with the leftovers, I think is actually a nice way to celebrate the holiday in any ethnicity.
We'll look at Mark Bittman's suggestions for dealing with the leftovers. Maybe the most fun of all right there. Here's Carrie writing in saying, I'm making a pecan pie right now. We are fortunate that most of our meal this year is local. The pecans are from my parents, eggs from my chickens, and a lot of the veggies are from our CSA. We'll celebrate with friends and couldn't be happier. Ruth in Narragansett, Rhode Island. Ruth, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about method for peeling little boiling onions. You know, is there a trick to this? Because I've got 3 pounds. I'm making golden onions, which my family likes. They're in a cream sauce with grated carrot.
So funny that this question just came up, because I was really about to say, when you asked Clotilde the question about heritage and stuff, I was about to say, try to get Americans to eat creamed onions on any day of the year other than Thanksgiving.
Right.
And yet here now on Thanksgiving, everybody, oh, my grandmother's creamed onions. Anyway, you know, I would say the way to peel little onions is to boil them for 30 seconds or a minute first, and then the peel slips off. Clotilde is nodding in approval, I think.
I hadn't thought of that. That's wonderful. I usually end up eating all my pearl onions in the summer grilled, because it's more worth it then than saving them for Thanksgiving.
But if you still got them, a little boil and off comes that skin.
Yeah, I think, yeah.
It slips right off after that.
Ruth, good luck with your creamed onions on Thanksgiving Day. Liz in Newton, Massachusetts. Liz, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom. This is making me really, really hungry. My husband and I are great fans of Tom Bittman. We use his book, How to Cook Everything, all the time. I know that Mark Bittman's also a food justice advocate and has done a lot of work in that area.
Mm-hmm.
And the conversation so far has been a lot about what's going on locally. And the question I have for him today is, so do you think it's important in getting a good food system and a just food system in this country to also look at reforming the global food system?
Mark Bittman, you've got a big take on food. It's way beyond the turkey in the oven. We've just got a minute before the break, but give us a first bite at that, Mark.
Well, yes, of course. I think it's worth considering how we look at how we eat affects how other people eat, and it's worth looking at how we can think about feeding now 7 billion people and in theory, at least in a few decades, 10 billion people. I think it can be done. You know, the problem really is, or the initial problem is, that there isn't a global food system, and the question is how to get to a place where there is.
Though there sure is a lot of grain shipped all over this big world, and the blueberries
sure
flown in from Easter Island. It sounds like
some
kind of
get
system.
Me some of those.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour on the eve of Thanksgiving about autumn feasting and the food we eat with New York Times food guru Mark Bittman, best-selling author of How to Cook Everything, How to Cook Everything Vegetarian, Food Matters, and much more. Joins us today from a studio in Montpelier, Vermont, where he is alongside Clotilde Horishko. She is owner of Camp Horishko, an organic farm and CSA in Brookfield, Vermont. They grow melons and asparagus and corn and beets, pumpkins, onions, squash, and right on down very late into the season. Big storm up the eastern kind of seaboard right through her area these days. 10 to 12 inches of snow on that farm as we speak. Brussels sprouts in just in time. Mark, here's one for you from Susanna, and she writes on the website onpointradio.org. She says, what do you make, this is for you, what do you make of the current foodie age? Do you see this as a reactionary return to the basics in a hyper-connected, high-tech age, or maybe the other end of the spectrum, Susanna writes, another thing that we can have, you know, cooking and eating well as a badge of affluence, or something else entirely? How do you see the foodie age, Mark?
Very complicated question, and not unrelated to what you were talking about in the last hour, the sort of division between rich and poor,
mm-hmm.
because Of course, it's an estimate, but I think that 5 to 10% of the population in the United States is eating really, really well right now and eating really intelligently right now. And a lot of the rest of the population is relying on industrially produced food and hyper-processed junk. So, I'm not really wild about the word foodie. I'm not wild about an obsession with food that leads people to watch cooking on television. But I'm really happy to hear, people calling in and talking about harvesting their own stuff or getting food from their neighbors or cooking traditional foods. And, I'm hopeful that more and more people will it's not so much a question of being a locavore or growing your own stuff, although I think those things are great, but will be more conscious on a daily basis of eating higher quality stuff that they that they prepare themselves. So that sort of answers the question.
I mean, you were writing earlier this month yourself about what we expect in the stores these days and what we prepare. And you wrote, we expect a steady supply of fresh, quote-unquote, Peruvian asparagus, Canadian tomatoes, South African apples, Dutch peppers, Mexican broccoli. You wrote, this is just
Easter Island blueberries.
But that the United States, for everything that we produce agriculturally in this country, is unable to supply its own fruits and vegetables. You called that pathetic, just plain embarrassing.
Well, it is. And we do supply fruits and vegetables. We do produce fruits and vegetables, obviously, but not on the order that we'd need if we were to eat as many fruits and vegetables as the USDA recommends. And, fruits and vegetables at this point are called specialty crops because the real crops, the crops that Americans are best at growing, are soy and corn and wheat and rice and other commodity crops. But it's not entirely clear that we can support ourselves agriculturally locally, but I think regionally, if there were more farmers of medium-sized farms growing fruits and vegetables, raising meat sustainably, we could have a reasonable diet that was largely produced here. And I don't say that because I'm an isolationist or a protectionist, but I think the quality of food will be higher, and I think more people will be engaged in productive and rewarding work, and I think our diet will be better, and those are things I'm interested in.
Well, and you wrote in a recent column about things you're thankful for on the eve of Thanksgiving that, in fact, the number of farms in this country is growing again.
Number of farms is growing, but it's extremely difficult for young people to be able to afford farmland because farmland that grows corn, especially this year with subsidized ethanol and a high demand for it makes what was once farmland that was affordable to everybody now extremely expensive. So, I think we need to look at our priorities and say, how do we get young people interested in young people are interested in farming. How do we get young people able to be able to afford farms and to work farms in a way that will help them support themselves and their families while providing that food for those of us who live in the same region.
It's almost Thanksgiving. Let's hear from people doing that right now. Cindy in, Caneyville, Kentucky. Cindy, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What's your Thanksgiving dinner going to look like? Where's it come from?
Well, it comes from our farm. We're going to butcher some chickens, and we're going to have apple pie from canned apples and green beans. We did have to buy our potatoes. They didn't do well this year, but we tried to grow everything here on our little homestead, and so that's basically what we're going to have, and we enjoy it. And we're actually going to be cooking everything on a wood-burning cook stove.
Wow, you've got the homestead life going there. Is it your occupation, Cindy, or are you growing all this on the side? Is it your job?
We're growing it on the side. My husband works as a teacher, and I do have a degree in engineering, but I've chosen to stay home and homeschool the children. And we started doing this for two reasons. First of all, it's good economically. We realized that it was good for your health, and also it was nostalgia. We always heard our parents say, back in the good old days, and so we thought, well, we're going to try bringing that back for our children, and we really enjoy this endeavor.
Is it just on a big feast day like Thanksgiving when you do it, or are you eating produce off your own land a lot?
Yeah, we do this all the time, year-round, and so it's become a way of life for us. And it has made Thanksgiving more meaningful. We eat a lot more simple meals on a day-to-day basis, and we don't cook a lot unless it's for something like Thanksgiving. But we do eat very healthy.
Cindy, would you remind us, just for people who have become very distant from this, exactly how you prepare that poultry that you're going to be butchering out of your own farm tomorrow? How do you get the feathers off? I've seen it many times, but a lot of people haven't these days.
Well, we're kind of clumsy about that. We're just going to take the skin off.
Oh.
So we've not quite figured out how to take the feathers off. And we still cook it every which way you can, just with the skin off. It still tastes pretty good.
All right. Well, fire up a boiler. Mark, I hear you there. Have you plucked your own chicken lately, or turkey, Mark?
Not lately, but I've done it. And it's true, it's not fun. It's work.
Yeah, it's work. Some of the best things in life are. Cindy, thanks for your call. Bobby in Augusta, Georgia. Bobby, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
The lady that had the heritage turkey.
Yes.
I've been doing my own turkeys for years, and I raised my own. And matter of fact, this past Sunday, it became a family affair with all my children and me. We butchered, and we pluck our turkeys, by the way. Use the old-fashioned scalding method.
Exactly, yeah.
That stuff that was handed down to me from my past.
Yep.
But one of the things I found out, if you take one, like the lady was saying earlier about the smoking the turkey is a bit, to me, the one of the best ways to cook the meat. And one of the things that I do, though, and it kind of happened by accident, I've taken to stuffing the turkey with pears, fresh pears, not cooked, not peeled.
Okay.
Fresh pears up into the body cavity.
Okay.
And it allows the turkey to keep the moisture. But I also, although I enjoy the smoked flavor, I don't want it to be too smoky.
Right.
So for the first hour or two of the cooking, I allow very little smoke to get to the actual turkey.
What kind of wood do you use for your smoking, Bobby?
Well, I spent 3 or 4 years driving a log truck, and one of the business was being able to grab the chainsaw and cut the tops that would not go on the truck from oak, from hickory. I prefer a red oak to hickory myself. It went fresh cut red oak and split. Has almost like a slight sugar cane smell to it.
Ooh, and can you pick that up in the turkey when it's on the table?
Yes, sir, you can.
Wow, fresh split red oak smoked turkey at Bobby's place. That sounds really great, Bobby. I appreciate your call. Sounds. Tell me one more thing. How long does it take? Let's say you've got a 20-pound turkey.
I'll be honest with you, I generally go between 3 and 4 hours, but I go very slowly.
Yeah.
I don't allow the heat to get too much into the smoker. And one of the keys, my wife and her family are real fans of a crispy skin. And it's one of the key things at the very end of the smoking process, I throw on some debarked, completely dry pieces of wood into the firebox, allow it to be fully consumed by the flames, which release, if the smoke is cut down at that point, and I rip the aluminum foil that I have covering the turkey off at that time, and I babysit it for the last hour, and I can get a nicely golden brown skin with that method, even in a smoker, instead of it having come out, look like it's the inside of a chimney.
Bobby, I think I'd like to come over to your house for Thanksgiving one day. And so does Mark. That sounds pretty terrific. Clotilde, there's a smoker who knows how it's done.
I would say yes. We just use maple in Vermont. Just make sure it's not pine.
Yeah, not pine. But Bobby, I love the subtlety that you've learned and put to work right there. That's just great. Let's go to David in St. George, South Carolina. David, you're on the air.
Thank you. I was wondering about the origin of a turducken.
Turducken. Oh, this is this like bird inside a bird inside a bird inside a bird thing.
Exactly.
Have you eaten it? This is what, a duck inside a turkey?
Oh, yeah. We had one last year, and we actually ordered it from a company in Louisiana. And they mailed the bird to us in a cooler. And it was frozen when we got it. They did it overnight.
Yeah.
And we cooked it. All together. We just stuck it in the oven. They gave us instructions and everything like that, and it was wonderful. And I just wanted to know how long this has been around and who came up with this.
Okay, Mark Bickman, vegan until dinner. Are you going to have a turducken on your table? This is a duck inside a chicken inside a turkey, sort of a triple treat there.
Actually, I think it's a chicken inside of a duck inside of a turkey. Well, I'm pretty sure it is Louisiana origin. I'm pretty sure it's recent. If I had to guess, I would say it was a Paul Prudhomme thing, but I'm not claiming to know.
Does it appeal to you, Mark?
In a bizarre kind of way, but you know, I think I'm sort of past the day of doing projects, cooking projects that I do for the sake of the challenge. So I don't really bone whole chickens anymore or things like that. I've done it. You know, I used to have to prove to myself that I could, but it's not really what I want to be spending my time doing.
I have a feeling most people are somebody's sending them that turducken as a Thanksgiving Day gift, maybe not really doing it. Jessica in Danbury, Connecticut. Jessica, thanks for calling. You're on the air. Hello, Jessica. You're on.
Hi. I am bringing lobsters to my parents in Ohio, and we assume that must have been a traditional meal in New England during this time of year. And we're going to cook up lobsters tomorrow. We wondered if you had any thoughts on that.
So never mind the turkey. You're going for, the turkey of the sea, the lobster. Do your parents welcome lobster from the coast? I assume you'll be scooting out there in a hurry. Are they happy to have those coming, Jessica?
They're thrilled. My parents are former East Coast people who now live in Ohio. And so my girlfriend and I are driving out with lobsters for them, and they're thrilled.
I love it. Mark Bittman, what do you say? Lobster for the centerpiece on Thanksgiving Day? How would you cook it?
I love it, too. I applaud this departure from turkey for sure.
Yeah. I guess just boil her up and make it grand there in the middle of the table. Yeah. Good luck with that, and drive safely through the weather there. Janie in Nashville, Tennessee. Janie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What's your plan?
I'm calling because the conversation stimulated some thoughts and memories of my childhood. I grew up on a farm in Iowa, and everything that we're trying to get back to today is what we did, only because if we didn't grow it or harvest it or raise it, we didn't have anything to eat. So it was the original sustainable food. Mm-hmm. And I just think that economic times and things like Food Inc. and everything that has been in the media now are stimulating people to really think about their food source when we didn't think about that in the past. And I had to smile as I'm driving here because the woman that did not know how to butcher her chicken, it was really, I was doing that at the age of 9, and I would more than happy to be able to tell her how to do that, and I don't really care if I ever do that again. But I just think this is a wonderful return to what's natural.
Jenny, I so appreciate your call. Mark, do you feel that happening? Do you think we're turning a corner with all the attention we pay to food? You know, we've seen the real problems in obesity in every which way. Pizza as a vegetable was the headline out of Congress recently. Do you feel the country and the culture turning in a better direction when it comes to food, Mark?
I do. We're not going to go back to it's a difference between sustainable and sustenance. We're not going to go back to a place where we're all farmers, or even, you know, there was a point at which 25% of us were farmers.
Yeah.
And I don't think we're going to go back to that. But we do need to move away from the direction we've been pushed in for the last 50 or 60 years, which is to be, you know, to expect everything at all times, to be eating constantly, to be eating things that were barely or weren't recognizable or wouldn't have been recognizable as food by our grandparents. And some of that change is going to be more people farming. But I do think that more of that change has to be all of us being, you know, directly responsible for what we eat, how we buy things, where they're grown, how we cook them, how we eat them, rather than expecting to be, almost force-fed pap. What was that movie where the people were rolling around sucking on sodas all the time?
Oh, geez,
I can't remember.
Yeah, right. The cartoon. Hey, Clotilde, you're the farmer. What's the farmer put on the table for Thanksgiving Day?
Oh, well, I'm going down to my parents, and we'll have my brothers visiting as well. It will be the turkey with lots of vegetables, some from my parents' garden. A lot we'll bring down. Lots of desserts. Raspberry apple pie. We had a wonderful raspberry year this year. So that's what I'm looking forward to making this afternoon.
a good raspberry year, and so it's raspberry apple pie. Boy, that makes me ready for Thanksgiving just to think of it. Clotilde Hrischko with Camp Marischko, your organic farm there in Brookfield, Vermont. Clotilde, thank you so much for being with us today. Really appreciate your stories, the dirt under your fingernails.
Thank you for having me.
And Mark Bittman with the New York Times, author of How to Cook Everything, and on and on. Mark, it's always great to have you with us. Happy Thanksgiving. Thanks a lot for being here.
And to you, Tom, to everyone else, too. Thanks again.
Listeners in New England and all across the country, around the world, happy Thanksgiving from us here at On Point. It's great to be with you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Best to all.